Hello, my name is Dr. Terry Box. I am an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the University of Utah Health Sciences Center. The title of this talk is Referral for Liver Transplant Evaluation. Certainly, the description of the technique and challenges of the actual surgical procedure of liver transplantation is beyond the scope of this talk. But in this diagram, you see some of the challenges of this procedure, removing a very scarred and diseased liver from a space in which it is generally attached to everything surrounding it, taking it out in such a way that there are potential anastomoses between all the tubular structures that enter the liver, carrying blood, exporting bile, and on the backside of the liver, draining the liver of blood into the vena cava. This is recognized as one of the, if not the most challenging of surgical procedures, and it is worthy a moment's contemplation of the actual surgical challenges. When talking about referral for liver transplantation, there are several considerations that we will take in the process of going through this today. We will first look at the background of liver transplantation and the goals of that procedure. Also, the common indications in general for thinking about and referring somebody for liver transplantation, including cirrhosis, how it develops, and how it may change over a period of time. And with respect to the changes of cirrhosis, the timing of the referral, and ultimately the evaluation and patient selection by a committee of providers. When we woke up this morning, there were over 120,000 patients on a waiting list in the United States for organ transplantation. Of those 120,000, approximately 19,000 of them are waiting for liver transplantation. 19,000 patients waiting for liver transplantation, roughly 6,000 patients transplanted. This number has been relatively flat since 2008, after reaching a peak in 2006 and slightly falling off to this level. These 6,000 plus liver transplants performed annually in the U.S. are done at 137 liver transplant centers scattered across the United States, as you see in this map. Not surprisingly, the transplant centers are located in areas where populations are large, leaving some transplant centers to cover huge geographic areas. Liver transplantation was first done in the United States in the 1960s in somewhat of an experimental situation, and not surprisingly, the first few done were not long-term successes, but they did demonstrate the potential benefit of transplantation. Now, almost 50 years later, we have created significant successes. The purpose of a liver transplantation is to take the terminally ill who have no medical or surgical alternatives for survival and to restore them to nearly normal functional status, prolonging their life in a meaningful way and for a meaningful period of time. As opposed to those early days of almost no survival, and even the early part of the 1980s, when liver transplant was beginning to establish itself as a norm rather than an experimental procedure, our overall patient survival has improved dramatically, as is demonstrated for you in this slide. The expected one-year survival at this time is 90% at 1 year, 80% at 3 years, and 75% at 5 years. The mortality that occurs during the first year post-transplant occurs as a consequence in the vast majority of cases of a process that directly relates to the transplant experience. Complications of the surgery, complications of opportunistic or otherwise typical infections in an immune-suppressed individual, and on rare occasion, things that have little to do with the transplant. However, after that first year, the mortality that occurs slows down, as you see, and by and large are the same things that are responsible for the mortality of the population at large. So obviously, from the survival statistic at 1 year, liver transplantation has some risk, and it is important to select patients for liver transplantation where liver transplant actually provides a survival benefit. Through a calculation known as the model of end-stage liver disease, a score is produced, about which we will talk later. Suffice it to say at this point, however, that a MELD score less than 15 is one where the survival benefit of transplant is outweighed by the survival statistics of the person with cirrhosis or liver disease. However, after a MELD of 15 has been achieved, and certainly beyond that, the survival benefit lies with transplantation. When considering the indications for liver transplantation, there are four groups of individuals with liver disease that command that thought process. First of all, in a relatively small minority of patients, are those without previous liver disease who develop acute liver failure. Those individuals suddenly go into liver failure. They were teetering on death without any history of chronic liver disease. The vast majority of people considered for liver transplantation, on the other hand, have chronic liver disease, which has progressed over time to an advanced state of significant scarring in the liver that we call cirrhosis. Some of those patients with cirrhosis will have hepatocellular carcinoma, and other patients with primary liver cancers that is self-contained within the liver, hepatocellular cancer that is free of distant spread or local invasion, are also candidates for liver transplantation. And finally, those individuals with metabolic derangements, either acquired or congenital, also develop liver failure that qualifies for liver transplantation. In the United States, patients with end-stage chronic liver disease associated with cirrhosis account for approximately 80 to 85% of all the patients that are transplanted. The most common indication for liver transplantation is end-stage liver disease as a consequence of hepatitis C cirrhosis. Hepatitis C is the leading cause of cirrhosis and hepatocellular cancer in the United States today. Most of our patients, in fact 80% of our patients today with hepatitis C, were born between the years of 1945 and 1965. Most of those individuals contracted hepatitis C in their late teens through their 20s and have had their disease for 25 to 40 plus years. Somewhere between 30 and 50% of those patients with chronic hepatitis C will progress to cirrhosis and or liver cancer. Hepatitis C now accounts for 30% of all the adults on the liver transplant waiting list and remains today the leading indication for liver transplant, though it is certainly being chased hard by those patients with liver disease associated with fatty liver. The term cirrhosis is really a generic term that was coined in the 19th century by a French physician, René Laennec. Dr. Laennec is a very renowned physician. In fact, the name Laennec's cirrhosis is a consequence of his intense interest in the liver. And in those days, the leading cause of liver disease was alcoholic cirrhosis. Hence the correlation of the term Laennec's cirrhosis with alcoholic cirrhosis. But I stress that the term cirrhosis does not imply the cause of chronic liver injury. This term cirrhosis is characterized underneath the microscope or histologically characterized by the appearance of nodules of fairly normal appearing liver cells that are aggregated in clumps rather than in linear cords as would normally be the case. These nodules, which are regenerating hepatocytes, are surrounded by bands of fibrous tissue, and as the bands of fibrous tissue thicken, the extent of the cirrhotic changes of the liver progress. In a clinical circumstance, we think about two types of cirrhosis. There is the early, perhaps, and certainly straightforward and uncomplicated compensated cirrhosis, and there is the more serious and complicated decompensated cirrhosis. The natural history of most chronic liver diseases is a period of injury that is ongoing and unremitting, that is associated with inflammatory changes within the liver itself that bring in a host of cells trying to correct the underlying illness. As a consequence of the inflammatory cascade of the situation, fibrosis production is stimulated in the liver, and as cells die and drop out, they are replaced by scar tissue. As that scar tissue thickens and surrounds regenerating nodules of liver cells, cirrhosis develops. Early on and before it becomes complex or complicated, we talk about compensated cirrhosis. However, over a period of years after cirrhosis develops and as it progresses, we begin to see the complications of cirrhosis. And as we see patients with variceal hemorrhage and or ascites and or encephalopathy and or jaundice, we now determine, we declare, that they have decompensated cirrhosis. And as we will soon see, the development of decompensated cirrhosis is soon followed by marked deterioration of the patient, which will be relentless in almost all conditions and associated with death unless there is some intervening process such as liver transplant. When a liver becomes cirrhotic, two distinct developments occur. As liver tissue drops out and is replaced by scar, the ability of the liver to provide its usual metabolic and cleansing functions diminishes, and when it diminishes enough, complications or decompensation begins to occur. When liver insufficiency or liver failure due to metabolic dysfunction occurs, the two main manifestations of such are hepatic encephalopathy, a condition, as you know, associated with change in mental status, as well as jaundice, which occurs due to the liver's inability to secrete bilirubin and other organic anions into bile. Running concurrently with the development of broad bands of cirrhosis in an otherwise sponge-like liver, which is a highly vascular structure. In fact, 30% of the blood flow at any time is flowing into the liver. It typically trickles through this liver unimpeded and flows out the hepatic veins into the IVC. But much like a beaver dam that is partially obstructing the flow of a stream, as these bands of fibrosis obstruct flow of blood coming in through the large portal vein, pressure begins to increase in this obstructed pathway, and the blood that otherwise cannot get through the liver has to find its way back to the heart via other means, and collaterals begin to develop, collaterals we call varices. And when these varices enlarge in the esophagus or the stomach, variceal hemorrhage occurs. Also, in response to this shunting of blood through the collaterals, encephalopathy is made worse, already induced by liver dysfunction. And finally, the last consequence of note of portal hypertension relates to the weeping of clear fluid into the abdominal cavity in response to high portal pressures. The ascites that thereby results can become spontaneously infected, and peritonitis, a very morbid condition, develops. And because the volume of fluid lost from the bloodstream into the ascites can be substantial, the kidneys are affected and become dysfunctional, a process called the hepatorenal syndrome, or combined liver and kidney failure, will ultimately develop. As I mentioned earlier, cirrhosis begins mildly, progresses to a moderate condition, and therefore keeps on going ultimately to advanced complicated cirrhosis or death. The period of time it takes from the acknowledgement of cirrhosis on the part of the provider and the development of complications obviously is determined by the point at which that discovery is made in the course of the cirrhotic development. So some patients will decompensate quickly, some will not decompensate so quickly. But when taking large populations of cirrhotics, we see that over a course of several years, compensation inevitably occurs in most patients with cirrhosis. Almost a third of patients with cirrhosis, or a little bit more than a third of patients with cirrhosis, will have decompensated by the 60th month following their diagnosis, or by the end of year 5. They continue to decompensate over a period of time, somewhat stalling out if they don't have progressive cirrhosis. But for the most part, a cirrhotic is ultimately doomed to decompensation at some point down the road. When we look at the course of all cirrhotics at the time of their diagnosis who have not previously decompensated, the median survival is 9 years. In other words, 50% of those patients will be dead in 9 years. If we look at the population of cirrhotics who have decompensated, however, the median survival drops dramatically to 1.6 years. 50% of patients with an episode of decompensation will be dead in 1.6 years. That kind of statistic really leads us to the discussion about when should we be planning to refer our patients with advanced liver disease for liver transplant evaluation. Liver transplant, which restores health, which restores normal function, which enhances life's longevity. Over the years, there have been many attempts to predict mortality, and currently, the predictive model, the UNOS model for end-stage liver disease, the MELD, or MELD score, is used as the most reliable predictor of mortality for patients with advanced liver disease. The MELD score is calculated using an equation based on creatinine, bilirubin, and the blood clotting number, international normalized ratio, which relies on the proton. When one plugs in the creatinine, total bilirubin, and INR to this equation, scores between 6 and 40 are the result. Lowest risk patients have the lowest score. Highest risk patients have the highest score, and risk falls out accordingly in between. This is an excellent predictor of survival, and it is, as a consequence, used in the process of ranking patients waiting on the transplant list and therefore as a model for organ allocation. As you see in this graph, there is not a linear relationship between MELD score and mortality. As the score gets higher, the slope of the curve increases, the predicted mortality increases at a faster pace, and by the time the number 40 is reached, the predicted mortality over a 3-month or 90-day interval is in excess of 80%. The 3-month mortality with a MELD score of 40 is over 80%. These patients are indeed at high risk of dying. As you see pointed out, on the other end, the MELD score for patients with the mortality risk for patients with a MELD score less than 15 does not meet the survival risk criteria, and therefore patients with MELDs of less than 15 are not candidates for, nor should they be offered, a liver transplant under usual circumstances. As a point of education, you may hear of or read about another model that has been used in the past and actually still has some clinical relevance in assessing patients' survivability or mortality likelihood. The Childs-Turco-Pugh score, or the CTP score, is also a points-based system, and patients are classified as class A, B, or C based on their points allocation. Points are allocated on the subjective criteria of the difficulty of managing their encephalopathy or ascites and the objective numbers generated by their creatinine, total bilirubin, and prothrombin time. Those patients with low point totals in class A have high 5-year survivability, as do those patients in class B, but it only takes another decompensating event to push you into the higher class C, where you see the 1-year mortality is 35%. When dealing with patients who have chronic liver disease, you're typically dealing with patients who have a progressive disease. And in the vast majority of our patients with progressive liver disease, we unfortunately don't have effective alternative therapy. Or if they have already decompensated from their cirrhosis, they may not tolerate effective therapy. And those are the patients that we consider for liver transplantation. So when do we send them? When do we call our friends at our favorite transplant center and say, hey, I've got a patient that I think you need to see. I would like to refer them for transplant evaluation. As you see in the bold print at the top, the first bullet point, early referral is best. Regardless of what is going on, if you're even thinking about transplantation, frequently that's the time you pick up the phone and make the first call to your transplant center. And the reason for this need to get on board early is the donor shortage to which we previously alluded. Even if the patient has a MELD under 15 and is on the waiting list, after that next episode of decompensation that pushes them within transplantable range, they're there if you're not struggling after the fact to get them on the list. For individuals who don't have a history of liver disease but who have acute fulminant hepatic failure, typically manifest by encephalopathy and coagulopathy, because there is no portal hypertension to create the other manifestations of decompensation, there should be immediate and extremely urgent referral to the transplant center. On the other hand, for your patients with chronic liver disease who have become cirrhotic, as we know, the MELD score and to a certain extent the CTP score are predictors of mortality, certainly measures of the severity of the disease. And if you're following along, calculating MELD scores or CTP scores as you go along, when the MELD score reaches 10 or greater, call your transplant center. CTP score 7 or greater, call your transplant center. And as we have already shown, at that time of that first decompensation, the horse may be out of the barn. They may be dying within months. They have a 50% chance of dying within a year and a half. Patients with hepatocellular carcinoma who meet certain criteria called the Milan criteria need to be referred to the transplant center. Those criteria are fairly straightforward, should be small volume, not so many nodules of cancer, fewer than 3 preferably, none greater than 3 centimeters, no local vascular invasion, no distant metastases. These patients should get a quick referral to liver transplant centers so their cancer can be treated, kept in check so they can be ultimately transplanted. And finally, anybody who has combined liver and kidney failure, that is a consequence of the liver disease, requires a quick call to the transplant center. Once that call is made, the thought processes kick in on the other end of the trail to liver transplant. The providers at the transplant center will begin to look at the data that is sent with the patient. And as we have already alluded to, that data is going to confirm the patients have chronic liver disease with hepatocellular failure, underscored by the fact that serum albumin is low, prothrombin time is increased, encephalopathy, ascites is present, and hyperbilirubinemia is present. These are fairly hard and objective findings, but there are patients who need to be considered for liver transplantation whose hard findings sometimes don't stand up to close scrutiny as far as clearly indicative of the need for transplant. For those of you who take care of patients with hepatitis C, you know that fatigue is a serious problem for those individuals, and sometimes it is incapacitating fatigue. And when it is justified to be due to the liver failure alone, it can be indications for liver transplant. Not only fatigue, but other issues uniquely associated with end-stage liver disease can lead to an unacceptable quality of life that would indicate the need for liver transplant. Things like refractory pruritus that literally prevents sleep, drives people to near psychosis, does not respond to any means of therapy, is another consideration. Patients with severe high bilirubin cholestatic liver injury who don't secrete bile into the gut waste their bones because they don't absorb vitamin D. They don't metabolize the precursors of vitamin D. They don't absorb calcium. Their bones waste away. They have metabolic bone disease that's incapacitating. And then you have the many other manifestations of hepatic decompensation that we have previously talked about that are considerations not for referral, but now for transplantation itself. After scrutinizing the medical aspects of the referred patient, there are other considerations that also require input from a multidisciplinary specialty group of people. Can the patient survive the rigors of an incredibly onerous liver transplant procedure and the sometimes very challenging and extended postoperative period? If the answer to that is no, no transplant should be performed. Is the patient willing and capable of complying with a relatively complex medical regimen to which one must adhere for the rest of his or her life after transplantation? Again, if the answer to that is no, transplant shouldn't be done. Finally, are there otherwise occult conditions that would compromise a successful transplant by taking out the transplanted liver prematurely, by otherwise shortening the survival period, by otherwise compromising the patient's quality of life? There are also special circumstances that consume a lot of energy when considering patients for liver transplantation, and the most vexing is likely substance abuse, alcoholism being the leading candidate. The 137 liver transplant centers across the country probably have somewhat unique and slightly variable ways of dealing with alcoholic liver disease, but I can tell you that the one steady, predictable, unifying, philosophical approach is that only patients having psychosocial factors predicting long-term sobriety are accepted for liver transplantation. This commitment to sobriety has to be played out in the actions of the potential recipient by participating not only in a rehab program, but in an ongoing relapse prevention program. Potential subjects, potential transplant candidates who cannot or will not participate in rehab and relapse prevention will not be considered for transplant. The older individuals, those over the age of 60, are certainly considered for liver transplant. Approximately 10 to 12% of our transplants currently are done on individuals greater than 65. But as we age, comorbid conditions begin to intervene. So particular attention is paid to discovery of silent coronary or other vascular diseases that may be a surprise in the operating room or otherwise compromise recovery. Moreover, if there are underlying diseases such as degenerative neurologic conditions that would compromise an anticipated post-transplant survival of 5 years or more, serious consideration for disallowing that patient comes up. Finally, as we have already talked about, hepatocellular carcinoma carries with it its own set of criteria for transplant. There are some occurrences that are absolute, not relative, but absolute contraindications to transplant. The most common one that is very straightforward would be the discovery of irreversible brain damage. And that typically occurs in your acute fulminant hepatic failure patients who have swelling of the brain as a result of their acute liver failure with herniation and irreversible brain damage as a consequence. We've already talked about patients who have multi-organ system failure, not correctable by transplant. Patients with any malignancy outside the liver, skin cancer being excepted, are not candidates for transplantation. At least temporarily, if not permanently, individuals with active infection outside the hepatobiliary system cannot be transplanted. Of course, anybody actively abusing alcohol or other substances is not allowed. Cardiopulmonary disorders we've talked about. And there are patients who, because of their psychosocial circumstances, simply cannot be transplanted because they cannot be relied upon to take care of the transplant, either because of intellectual ineptitude, behavioral issues, or social circumstances which make such impossible. More commonly, decisions to list somebody for transplant are complicated by relative contraindications, and we've talked about many of those. I would point out to you on the comorbid conditions, severe malnutrition, which is highlighted, as well as HIV positivity. HIV positivity used to be an absolute contraindication. Now, with the effectiveness of heart therapy for control of HIV replication, patients who are typically co-infected with hepatitis B and or C who have cirrhosis are now being considered for and actually undergoing transplant in centers that are acutely attuned to this and ready to manage these complex patients post-op. I stress that the HIV has to be under control, but if it is, these co-infected patients are transplant candidates. Severe malnutrition is part and parcel of advanced liver disease because the liver, being the main metabolic organ, cannot handle, cannot process, cannot make benefit of nutrients put into the system. All patients with cirrhosis should pay attention to a healthy liver lifestyle, which means attention to sound nutritional principles. And as patients begin to waste away with cirrhosis, nutritional intervention is a must in order to keep them potentially active on a liver transplant list. Patients so malnourished that they can't get up and walk around the room are not going to be candidates for liver transplantation. Finally, there are some anatomic issues which make the challenge of an already challenging surgery almost impossible. Previous surgery within the bed of the hepatobiliary tree and surrounding areas can sometimes foul the surgical approach so that transplant simply cannot be done, as does extensive thrombosis in the system feeding blood to the liver, including the portal vein, superior mesenteric vein, and splenic vein. The process of the provider getting patients through a long-term chronic liver illness, cirrhosis, and decompensation is challenging, but not all of the work falls to the provider who is managing the patient or the providers who will subsequently be providing the transplant. Patients themselves must participate in their own health. Certainly those patients with substance and chemical dependency must participate in a program, as we have already stated, and documentation of that participation is critical. Morbid obesity carries huge risk for postoperative complications following a transplant, and in some situations makes the surgical procedure practically impossible because of the depth of the cavity in which the surgeons must operate. Patients who are morbidly obese with a male greater than 35 are strongly encouraged to initiate on their own a weight loss program that is effective. BMIs of greater than 35 are relative contraindications to liver transplantation. Smoking is not allowed. Use of habituating medications, narcotics, and other sedating drugs is strongly discouraged, though for patients who have a history of chemical dependence who are on a methadone program, that certainly is not a barrier to transplantation. After the patient has been referred to the liver transplant center and has gone through a process which includes a thorough history and physical examination, an exhaustive review of psychosocial circumstances, as well as the financial capabilities to afford this procedure, and dozens of laboratory studies, imaging tests, and consultations from other specialists. Committee made up of transplant surgeons, transplant physicians, transplant nurse coordinators, transplant social workers, transplant financial people, and any other advocates or individuals who may have meaningful input discuss all points and ultimately make a decision to put the patient on the transplant list, accept them for liver transplant, reject them because of medical conditions, social conditions, or unfortunately for financial issues, or provisionally accept them pending further evaluation, further attention to substance abuse, further records review, further attempts to provide adequate funding for this experience. Once that exception is made, once the patient is determined to be an appropriate candidate, all records are forwarded to the payer. The payer signs off. The payer goes on the list, and now we hurry up and wait for that opportunity for our patient to be transplanted. In summary of what we just heard, I'd like for you to take away some critical points. First and foremost, liver transplantation works. It is a near miraculous outcome when the terminally ill, those with no medical and surgical alternatives, receive a liver transplantation and have restored health and extended life longevity. The gift of life has been accomplished. However, as we have heard, because of the donor shortage, when one looks at the percentage of those on the waiting list and compares it to the number being transplanted on an annual basis, we are actually in a declining situation with regards not only liver but all organ transplants. The donor shortage is critical. We have effective therapy. We have shortage of donors. Taking care of patients with chronic liver disease and cirrhosis is a challenge, and one of the biggest challenges is knowing when to refer those patients to liver transplantation. Understanding the progression of cirrhosis, the significance of the development of complications, helps the provider make a timely referral to the transplant center. Early referral, better outcomes. As we just discussed, patients have to take ownership of their health if they are expecting to be seriously considered as a liver transplant recipient, and overall healthy lifestyles certainly will get them to that point, that onerous surgery, that protracted recovery, that nearly miraculous gift of life in better condition. Finally, we should all be willing to make this work. Consider making the commitment to organ donation yourself, making sure your family and friends are aware, making sure your patients are aware that the gift of life is ours to make.